Hello, everybody. My name is Hector, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Rich for a wonderful 3-minute pitch. Let's give him a round of applause. I don't know about you, but I already got the message. If he was doing what he was doing, look the way he looks, that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I want to thank Stephen for asking me to speak and Kim for picking me up today at the airport. I almost did not make it. My plane was canceled, and I could not get here until 10 o'clock tonight. And I drove home. I said, God doesn't want me to speak at that convention. You know, and I got to my home and I called Kim and she says, well, Hector, you can fly to Oakland. I'll pick you up. You mean I had to drive again back to the airport? And I did, and I'm here. So I guess it was God's will that I had to speak here tonight. I also want to tell you, I just came back for a 14-week vacation in Argentina. And for 14 days, that's 8, I'd party and I didn't sleep. And I just traveled 14 hours to get to L.A. So if I'm not really, really up for the pitch, I hope you understand. Although, you know, I know I'm in the spiritual way of life. You know, I'm not doing this. God is doing this. I'm just a channel. The book says, our book says, you know, I'm of myself, I'm nothing. But the Father within, that's everything. So let's hope that God is good tonight, okay? And if you don't like this pitch, you know who to blame. Okay. I want to tell you up front that whatever I say from the podium, it's just my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated. And I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. Okay? Also, whatever I say from the podium is just my experience and applies only to me. That's a spiritual law. Whatever I say is a law unto myself, you know. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. My father is an Arab, my mother is an Italian, and I was born in Argentina. I'm glad you think it's funny. I think I came out Japanese. They were poor. They were illiterate. They were violent, they dressed badly, and they smelled even worse. You see, we're poor like in Argentina, poor in this country, like middle class all around the world, you know. We didn't have a bathroom, we had dirt floors, you know, no running water, you know, no heat. I want to tell you this story because when I came to America, you know, one day I saw an article about poverty in America. And they had this black lady in Harlem sitting on a couch watching TV. She's poor and she has a couch. She's poor and she has a TV set. And the whole article was about how bad the plumbing was in the apartment. Plumbing? What the hell is plumbing? We have no stinking plumbing. You know, we had a pump outside the house, you know. We had an outhouse with filthy, rotten piss on the floor, you know. I was very ashamed of my background, so I never invited any kids to come inside the house. My parents were very violent, and I was an abused child. But I never knew I was an abused child until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you see. Here they give you all these problems, you know. I thought everybody, you know, got chained to the sewing machine. My mother used to chain me to the sewing machine. It was nothing personal, really, you know. She also chained my kid sister and the dog. She was an equal chainer, you know what I mean? She just chained everybody, you know. And that didn't bother me too much, you know. Just sit there, you count the tile and daydream about masturbation when you're 12 years old. You know what I mean? What you're going to do. But what she did that really scared me was that when I would do something mischievous, and I'm not talking about smoking pot or joining a gang, because I didn't even know what pot was in Argentina 50 years ago, you know. And she said, I'm not going to chase after you. You have to come to sleep. So 1 o'clock at night when I was sound asleep, she would uncover me and beat me up with a shoe or a piece of wood. So I wake up being beaten up, I don't know what's going on. So for the first 18 years of my life, I slept totally covered because I didn't know what was coming at night. And my father was even more violent. He would get a knife or a gun when he would get angry. We'd all run through the street in the middle of the night, you know. So I didn't grow up to be a very secure, full of self-esteem young man, you know. My first dream as a child was not to be president of Argentina, a doctor, or a movie star. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. With a dull razor blade. See, I was very afraid of them, you know. And I'm not telling you this because it has anything to do, you know, with my alcoholism. I'm telling you all this because I'm going to tell you how I dealt with it when I got sober. Because in AA, we heal everything by working the steps. Since I was very, very young, I knew I was coming to America because I had seen pictures of you in the magazines, and I wanted to come here. Since I was 7 or 8 years old, I'm going to America. Because if I knew I would come here, you know, everything would be fine, you know. And I saved myself. When I was 12 years old, I got into sports, and I would come home, drop the books, and go to the gym. When I was 18 years old, you know, I left my home. And when I was 24 years old, I came to the USA. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration. It's too late now, okay? And I landed in New York, you know. This hick little boy from Argentina, from illiterate parents, you know, poor home, goes to the easiest place in the world to live, New York, you know. And I just fell in love with it. I'm still in love with America, you know. Sometimes I feel it takes a foreigner to really appreciate this. And I've been to about 20 countries, and we know we had the best year. And I began working really hard. I began working in advertising, you know. And at the beginning, I had trouble because I had studied. When you come here legally, you have to show them, you know, you have some ability to work and you know English. But my English teacher in Argentina was a British teacher. Hello, Hector. Oh, no, no. Ta-ta. And I want to speak like you. And he said, oh, no, no, those Americans, they don't speak English, you know. They're so terrible. So I learned how to speak like that. And in New York, nobody speaks like that. And I didn't know I had an accent. You know, if you think I have an accent now, you should have heard me, you know, 40 years ago. And I remember I went to this movie, you know, with this young lady. To see a movie with Gina Lollobrigida and Rock Hudson. And all of a sudden, I realized that Gina had an accent. And I said to this young lady, boy, she has a thick accent. And she said, oh, no, no, no. It's very charming, just like yours. I have an accent? And she said, oh, yes, and so adorable. And I went home, and I bought a tape recorder. And caca, 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 did I have an accent? I sounded like Frito Bandido, you know what I mean? I sounded like my parents in Argentina. My parents in Argentina were foreigners, and they had accents. Now I sounded like them. Anyway, I worked really hard. I worked as a graphic designer in advertising. I worked really hard. I had no friends, and I worked Saturdays and Sundays. And in a year and a half, I saved enough money to go to Europe, and I went to Europe, and I visited all the museums, and I saw all the great art of the world, which is kind of unusual, coming from a home that there wasn't a single piece of art or painting on the walls. But I guess that's what I really loved. And when I came back, you know, I was kind of changed. And I always wanted to socialize and meet you, be with the Americans, you know. And I said, somebody told me, Hector, in order to socialize in America, you have to go to the bar. I'd never been to a bar. So I practiced going to a bar. See, I wanted to be sophisticated. I wanted to be like Rex Harrison. You know, the older guys know. Rex Harrison, you know what I mean? And I practiced. I got into my three-piece suits in front of the mirror. Oh, by the way, my first dream when I came to America, I wanted to be a wasp. you know. But no matter how I dressed, you know, in those days I had a big black afro and a huge black mustache. And no matter how many Brooks Brothers suits I got and, you know, how I dressed, I always looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know. I just never made it, you know, somehow. So I'm going to a bar to beat Americans, right? So I get in front of the mirror, my three-piece suits from Brooks Brothers. I practice. I looked in the mirror and I go, whiskey, you know. I just want to sound sophisticated. Whiskey, you know. So I get into this bar and I walked in. I've never been to a bar, remember. And all the guys are tall, blonde with crew cuts, you know. They all look like Mormons, you know. And all the ladies very well dressed. And I thought to myself, this must be a Mormon bar. You see, I didn't know the Mormons didn't drink, you know. Because, you see, the only Americans I knew in Argentina were the Mormon missionaries. They used to come to my little town in Argentina to try to change us. To try to change us from unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. And they were very nice people, you know, but they all dressed the same way. That crew cuts in Argentina in those days, nobody had a crew cut. You know, dark suits. So when I walked into this bar, I said, this is a Mormon bar. You know, so the tall guy, the bartender comes over and goes, see, English to us is like Spanish to you when you don't know it. It's gibberish. But I was prepared. I said, whiskey, you know, and he insisted. I kept saying, whiskey, you know. Now in hindsight, I realized he was asking me, what kind of whiskey on the rocks with soda? I don't understand. And I kept saying, whiskey, whiskey. He got pissed. So he grabbed this little glass, a shot glass, and a funny-looking bottle with a beak. And he poured this piss-like substance into the little glass and put it in front of me. See, I've never seen, you know, a shot glass in my entire life. So I look at this little glass. Why does he give me such a little glass? And I look around, all the Mormons had tall glasses, you know. Why does he give me such a little glass? Is it because I am short? Or maybe he's trying to punish me, you know, because I'm not a Mormon. But I'm trying to act macho. So I picked up the little glass and I swallowed the whole thing in one take. Oh, it was awful. It came out of my ears, my eyes, you know, I got awful. And this Mormon that was standing next to me, who looked like Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, remember? And he says, ¿Por qué no prueba Cuba Libre in Spanish? Why don't you try Cuba Libre? Easy to pronounce. Cuba Libre, por favor. Cuba Libre, Cuba Libre. I loved it. See, I'm addicted to sugar. It was rum and coke. And it was sweet. I loved it. From then on, I drank everything with coke. It's scotch and coke. Vodka and coke. And finally, I graduated to my drink of choice. Sangria and coke. Hey, don't knock it before you try it. You don't know. So don't give me, you know, that crap. Anyway, I began drinking a lot, really a lot. And I began drinking by myself. I was very much an isolator, you know, very much a lonely person. I always looked good, I sounded good, but I don't want anybody to get to know me, you know. So I began to isolate. Once I read the book called Loneliness, The Fear of Love. You don't have to read the book, that's it. You know. That means we are the person who I isolate are basically because, you see, if I get to know you and you get to know me, you're not going to like me. So I stay away from everybody. I was very much an isolator. And because I worked really hard and, you know, I accomplished all the things that I wanted. You know, I had the apartment, the furniture, the clothes. I had a beautiful apartment with a magnificent view of Manhattan. But I still felt like a piece of garbage. And I didn't know why. You told me why when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I was looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing that I can see with my eyes, nothing can fix my insides. You see, the book says on page 45, the main purpose of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. It's not the right girlfriend, boyfriend, furniture, clothes, job, or car. Those things are wonderful, and they give me physical comfort. But if I want the inner peace, the solace, that, you know, that condition that we call sobriety, it comes only from a relationship with a higher power. God could and would. He doesn't say Marlboro cigarettes could and would. He doesn't say, you know, food could and would. You know, there's only one solution. That solution is God. I didn't know that. And I kept accumulating more and more things, and I felt more and more unhappy, you know. And I remember, I don't know why, I had my first suicide attempt. Don't ask me why, I don't remember. I was very, very unhappy. I got drunk every day. And I was very, very unhappy. And one day, I don't know why, I took 40 pills. And I remember the sensation, you know. It was like a horizontal line was coming down. And it was very peaceful. I don't have to be tall. I don't have to be good looking. I don't have to conquer New York. This is good. This is peaceful. Of course it was peaceful. I was dying. But the phone rang. I am in my deathbed, but I'm nosy. So I picked up the phone. It was my friend Rudy. And Rudy realized right away what I had done. He said, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital in 3 minutes, I call the cops. Click! He hung up. Oh my God! I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing! So I floated to Bellevue. And they pumped my stomach. And they made me see shrinks. And I began seeing shrinks. And I saw many, many shrinks. And they were all good. But they could not help me because I never told them the truth. You know? And I realized, since having all the stuff, the furniture, the clothes, the money, didn't fix me, I know what was going to fix me if I become an actor. And everybody loves me, I'm going to be okay. And I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III in London better than Olivier. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English, you know. And I became an actor, you know. And I said, oh, if I see myself on TV in a commercial, I'm going to be okay. And I saw myself in the commercial, and two commercials, and three commercials. And I said, oh, no, 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 Hector. Any idiot can do commercials. Even Joe Namath does commercials. No, no, you got to do theater. Theater, Hector. And God said, okay, you little idiot, I'll show you. And I got into this play. And this play went from off-Broadway to Broadway. And we became the toast of the town. The best play on Broadway. We won the Tony and all the awards. I remember walking on stage, the first preview on Broadway. I couldn't say the lines. I was so in awe that this piece of garbage was on Broadway, I couldn't say the lines. I had to improvise the scene. And we won all the awards. We were the toast. And still I felt like a piece of garbage. And I had my second suicide attempt. I threw myself in front of the bus because it didn't stop. You see? And when I came to AA, I didn't think my life was unmanageable. You know, people throw themselves in front of the bus all the time. And one day I woke up, you know, I came to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I was really great hangover, and I had a moment of clarity. We all have that. I realized what my problem was. I know. My problem is New York. You see, this is a hostile, unfriendly, terrible city. I had to move to a more loving, caring, nurturing place. So I moved to Hollywood. And you know, I'm an isolator, right? But in New York, you know, you go down the elevator, you open the doors, 10,000 people, right? They're all ready to mug you, but still they're there, right? In L.A., to get mugged, you need a car. You know what I mean? Everything is forced. So I became more and more isolated. And I got into television at this show and that show. And And I, you know, I saw myself in many TV shows, and I was never happy. And I got an idea. I know what's going to make me happy if I get a Mercedes. And God said, okay, you little idiot, I'll show you. And God stole my Mustang. And I went and bought a Mercedes. I couldn't believe that this piece of garbage had a Mercedes. I used to park in front of one of those windows, you know, big windows in the store, and look at myself in the mirror. Look at Hector! Hector has a Mercedes! And because I had no friends, you know, to visit, I'm an isolator, I drive around the block, you know, I go to the supermarket, and then I drive around the block singing, I have a Mercedes, hookie hookie, Hector has a Mercedes. At night, I get drunk and go to the garage, in the basement of the building, and shine my Mercedes, you know, with my pajamas, and baby talk to my Mercedes in Spanish. Ay, que lindo el Mercedito, que bonito que está. Tan lindo el Mercedito. You know. And I didn't think my life was unmanageable when I came here. Anyway, I'm going to get to my bottom. And I was a, you know, Latino actor. In those days, I had black hair, black mustache. You know, and I was always playing bad guys, killing people, molesting women, selling children, smuggling dope, you know. I was always getting arrested. I'd been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers, you know what I mean? But finally, I got this part, you know, to be a good guy in a movie. It was a sequel to Butch Cassidy. It was Wanted, the Sundance Woman with Catherine Ross. You know, Catherine Ross with a young girl in The Graduate, right? And I'm going to play a good guy. I'm going to save the girl. I couldn't believe it. I'm not going to get killed. I'm going to be the good guy. So they give me the part as this Pancho Villa's right-hand man, right? I'm going to be a heavy-duty bandito, you know, save the girl. And I got home and I got a call from the director. It says, Hector, we forgot to ask you a question. Can you ride a horse? Can I ride a horse? I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on a horse. I lied. So we get to location in Tucson, right? So we do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors, right? We're going to save the girl. So they put me on top of the horse. This is the horse. This is you. If you ride properly, this is the way you ride. Nice. When I rode the horse, it was like this. Oh, the director was not happy. He chewed me out. Why did you lie? We asked you specifically. We asked you. Oh, he got so pissed. He really chewed me out in front of everybody. So, you have to practice. So, they put me on top of that stupid animal for 4 hours. I couldn't get off. When I got off, I could not get my legs together. You know what I mean? It was like this. And my ass was a huge blister, you know. I couldn't sit. So I go to my hotel. I get some sangria and Coca-Cola. And I get drunk. Pissing drunk. So we get the next day to go. We're going to do the take now. So I come to the set and I say to the director, excuse me, sir, but I cannot ride a horse. My ass is a huge blister. He says, Hector, we don't give a shit. You see behind you, there's 200 extras, you see? We cannot hire them tomorrow. We have to do it today. But sir, it hurts. Hector, you do it today. So they put some wet towels on top of that thing. What do you call that thing? The saddle, right? And they sat me on top of it. Now think, I'm playing this heavy-duty macho bandito, right? With the bullets across my chest, the mustache, the hat, the guns, sitting on wet towels, you know what I mean? It's so embarrassing. Now they give me the guns, and we're going to do now the take. This Hector, don't cock the gun, and cock it only after you're galloping and shoot in the air. Because, you see, those blanks are very, very dangerous. Remember the good-looking guy who read in the paper who killed himself with a blank? If I get it this close, I blow your eyes out. So he said, be very careful, Hector, but I have a hangover, right? I'm an alcoholic. So, the six of us principals are on top of the horses, and they have the, what do you call the Marlboro guys, the wranglers, holding the reins of the horse. They slap the horses in the ass, and we take off. So the wrangler is there and says, I'm going to cock the gun. I'm going to get at least one shot. I'm terrified. I look behind me. It's 200 extras. These big Mexicans on horses. If I fall, I'm dead. So I say, I'm going to get one shot. So I cock the gun and I hold it like this and close my eyes. And the horse goes, boom. Oh my God, I shot the wrangler in the ass. Oh, he didn't think it was funny. So we do the take. We ride around the jail and save Catherine Ross. Now, it was not a good take, so we are going to do the take again. Now, he's holding the horse like this, really far away right now, and he's giving me a really nasty look. I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. I cocked the gun again, but because I'm intelligent, I put it next to my leg, and the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I don't care. I'm an alcoholic. I have to save the girl, right? And the flames are coming up, and I'm riding, and I see the flames coming up. You know, by the end of the take, it was like a torch on top of the horse. So I get to the end of the take, right? They threw me on the floor. They got the blankets. They put the fire out, and they rushed me to the hospital. I have a big hole about this size on my leg, right? So they had to rush me to L.A., and I was in the hospital for a whole month. They had to remove the infection because it got infected, and I have a skin graft. And while I was in the hospital, you know, my agent didn't send me flowers. And I'm sensitive. You don't send me flowers, I'll kill myself. I'll teach you a lesson. So I asked my friend Irene to bring me the pills. Oh, by the way, I never took pills, only when I wanted to kill myself. I always had like 30, 40 pills. In case something goes wrong, I kill myself, right? Only once I took a pill. It was a Black Beauty. Somebody in the gym gave me a Black Beauty. Says, Hector, if you take one of this, you're going to have a lot of energy. So, I'm a good boy. I went home and took the pill. Wow, I have so much energy. I cleaned my whole apartment twice in one day. I began making plans for the rest of my life. I couldn't stop. The only thing is I couldn't close my mouth. It was like... Never again. Jesus Christ. So anyway, I asked my friend Irene to bring me the pills, and I took the pills. Because my agent sent me flowers. I'm sensitive, you see. And that was my last suicide attempt. It was my best one. I was in coma for 3 days in the intensive care unit. I had 2 cardiac arrests. They had to revive me twice. I was dead, you know, for 3 days, basically, you know. And I had everything. I had enough money in the bank, you know, to live a whole year without working. I had a bright new Mercedes, you know, I had clothes. I had a gorgeous apartment. I had everything. The only thing I didn't have was Hector. I didn't know who I was. One of you described me from the podium. He said, I was a huge ball of fear covered with a little human skin. That was me. And the book says fear is the overwhelming quality of all alcoholics. It equates fear to a thief because it says it robs us of our lives. Remember, in the fourth step, the last column is fear, 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 fear. And that was really the basis of my life. And what is fear? Fear is the absence of love. And what is love? Love is God. And you know, in life we function on two energies. Either fear or love. And fear is the absence of love. You know, and love is God. I didn't know that. Anyway, I was in coma for 3 days when I came to, you know, I had 15 tubes this way, this way, that way, this way. My crotch was really black and blue, full of blisters because I kept urinating on myself. I was really, really a pathetic mess. And I had everything. They released me too soon and I went home and I was very, very frightened. For the first 2 weeks, I couldn't sleep. But within a few months, I was doing the same thing. My shrink sent me to AA. He said, Hector, you're an alcoholic. Go to AA. Mike, are you sure? And he said, "Is the Pope Catholic, Hector?" "Yes, go to AA." And I went to a meeting, and it was dark and seedy, and, "Ooh, no, 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 not for me." You know, I thought he was going to forget. And 2 weeks later, he says, "Hector, did you go to AA?" I said, "Oh, no, I went to this meeting. It's dark and seedy, bunch of losers. I don't belong there. I don't want..." "Hector, there's over 1,000 meetings in LA. Now it's 2,500, but 21 years ago, it was 1,000. And he says, "Try another one." He persisted, you know. And I went to another one. It was like this, very well lit, and the people looked good, and somebody was playing the piano. I said, "Wow, this looks like a musical comedy. Maybe I belong here," you know. And I stayed, and I've been sober over 21 years, you know, and I absolutely... Thank you. And I love AA. I really love AA. I call AA the mafia of love. You know, newcomers, once you come to a few meetings, you can't get out. We are everywhere. Especially newcomers, you know, when you come out of a 7-Eleven at 1 o'clock at night with a little brown bag in your hand, somebody's going to say, "Hi! We haven't seen you at meetings. How are you?" Anyway, newcomers, stay with us. Nobody wants you anyway. This is the last stop. It's either this or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know? Now, stay with us and let us love you until you learn how to love yourself. And, you know, I've been sober over 21 years, and I still do the same things that I did when I came in. I go to meetings. I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I work the steps. I pray. I meditate. And I have 3 commitments. And I don't do that because I'm good spiritual. I do that because I'm a flake. And I know for sure, I don't know about you, if I stop doing all the things that I do, I will drink for sure. And I like what's happened to me. You know, for somebody who really hated himself, now, most of the time, I'm at peace with myself. You know, and I did the steps, and I worked the steps, and I made my amends. But it took me a long, long time to realize what the program was all about. And what I am about to say applies only to me. Everything I say applies only to me, you know. I'm going to talk a little bit about God and the steps, because to me, that's the program. God and the steps. The main purpose of this book, says on page 45, is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. This program is not about getting in touch with your feelings. Don't worry about getting in touch with your feelings. Your feelings will get in touch with you. This program is not to be like in L.A. We're very hip in L.A. Oh, yes, I want to share just to see where I'm at. You want to know where you're at? Check what's inside your underwear. That's where you're at. And if you are not wearing underwear, you better talk to your sponsor, okay? In AA, we wear underwear. Clean underwear, okay? Now, the whole purpose of this program is to develop a conscious contact with God. That's what I believe, you know. And I have problems with God because I come from a Catholic background, you know, and my God was not a loving God. My God looked like Charlton Heston, and he behaved like Leona Hemsley, you know. So I had to find a God that could really work with, something that really could help me. And I found this definition by Joel Goldsmith that I read a lot. He's a giant, a spiritual giant. He passed on, but he's incredible. And he wrote the following that really helped me. I want to share it with you. He said, "Regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong because it is still a concept. Eventually, I have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness that God is and then leave the subject alone, because with the mind, I'm never going to know what God is." And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 46 says the same thing. It says, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And then on page 53, the book says, God is everything or else He's nothing. God either is or He isn't. What was our choice to be? And the book also tells me where I can find God. It says, page 55, we found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that He may be found. It was so with us. And that's what I believe, that God is. How can I, a finite little man, define a spiritual entity that takes care of 6 billion people at the same time, when theologians and great spiritual authorities are not able to do, were not able to do it? And they told me, Hector, it's not important to define God, but to see God in everybody and everything. And more than talk about God and define God, really have the consciousness of God and really act like God would like you to act, in a loving manner, in a kind manner, in a compassionate manner. It's not just to talk about, you know, God and read about God, which is good. Eventually, that has to be part of my demeanor, of the way I carry on my life. You know, and it took me a long time just for me to realize what the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are for. And just for me, you know, we say work the steps to achieve sobriety. Yes, the end result of working the steps is sobriety. But for me, just for me, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. And if I do that, the compulsion will be removed. It said so on page 32, 12 and 12. It says, the fact was, we really had not clean house, so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. Therefore, we remain self-deceived, and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. That means that if I get enough grace, I will not have to drink anymore. And it's interesting that the word recovery is not used in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, the other word that I'm trying to think of that I forgot. See, I'm getting senile. Recovery and sobriety is also not used, not mentioned in 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not even the name of our disease, alcoholism, is mentioned in 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But this one word is mentioned 9 times. Check it out. That word is God. That word is God. You see? But I didn't know also what God's grace is. You taught me. You told me that God's grace is in. And God loves me not because I am good. God loves me because He is good. You see? And God's grace is available to everybody, not just to the good people in Alcoholics Anonymous. God's grace is like the sun. When the sun comes out, it shines on everybody. The murderer, the thief, the priest, the mom, the dad, and the child molester. The God shines on, the sun shines on everybody. And God's grace is available to all of us. But just like the sun, if I hide myself inside the house and pull the curtains, it cannot shine of myself. So the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for me are tools to unblock myself, because the book says I am blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit so that God can use me. This can be cleansed and I become a channel through which God can shine. That's all. And the first step says, I have a problem. The second step says, I need a solution. The third step says, that solution is God. I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I didn't know what the will and life was. You told me what was. My will is my thinking. As a man thinking, so he is. And what is my life? My life is my actions, the sum total of my actions. You see, a man or a woman is not judged by what he drives, how he dresses, how much money he makes, where he lives. A man or a woman is judged by his actions. Emerson said, your actions speak so loud, I cannot hear what you say. So that's what it is. So I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And how do I do that? I didn't know.
You told me I had to work the rest of the steps. I had to keep going. So, I had to turn my will and my life over to the girl God. In order to do that, I had to do 4 and 5. You see, I have all these character defects I practice on a daily basis. I had to know what they are. I do 4 and 5. 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. Then I go home and do 6 and 7. I look at the list, see if I forgot anything, if I've been very thorough, and then humbly ask God to remove these character defects once I know what they are. Right? And the book says that most of them will be removed, but with some of them I have to be content with improvement. That's why Bill, who wrote the big book in the 12 and 12, designed step number 10 later on. Am I ready to receive God's grace? Well, not really. See, when I was drinking, I did harm to all those people out there. So I had to make amends. So I can be really clean inside. I had to do 8 and 9. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the universe. Once that is cleansed, once that is really put in order, then I can receive God's grace. Am I ready to receive it? Yes, I am. But Bill Wilson knew we were alcoholics and we were going to screw up on a daily basis. So he gave us step number 10. It's a daily tool. We had to clean up the channel. We had to remain really clean, empty, empty, so God can shine through me. So whenever I make a mistake, I had to make amends. Now that I have, you know, some sort of relationship with God, how do I improve that? By doing 11, prayer and meditation. Coming from the Catholic background that I came, you know, I thought prayer was a deal-making with God. You know, if I do so-and-so, God, can I get laid? You know what I mean? No, Hector. We don't ask God for anything. Pray only for God's will and the power to carry that out. Pray only. You see, because I don't know what's good for me. I thought having the Mercedes was good for me. Being on TV was good for me. Having the expensive clothes was good for me. And I got all that, and I ended up dead for 3 days in the intensive care unit. So obviously, I don't know what's good for me. You know? So I had to pray for God's will. I had to say, God, please show me. Teach me. Guide me. I'm a channel for you. What is that you want me to do today? And it's wonderful that we do all the set prayers, that number 3, number 7, and the Lord's Prayer. It's wonderful. But it's important for me, just for me, to talk to God. To really develop a conscious relationship with God. Because if I want to be a friend with you, we have to talk. We have to argue. Sometimes we'll fight. God doesn't mind. Because if I'm fighting with God, I'm acknowledging God. You know, and they told me that prayer doesn't do anything to God. Prayer does something to the person praying. The nature of God doesn't alter. It's always love. Okay, and what do I do after I pray? I shut up my mouth, close my eyes, and meditate. And listen to the still small voice that is inside of me. The kingdom of God is within. Not everything that I need is inside of me. God cannot give me anything, not even sobriety, because sobriety is inside of me. God cannot give me anything, because everything He has is mine. He created me. The kingdom of God is within. And isn't it interesting that the 11th step ends up in silence? It's prayer and meditation. Why is that? I believe because silence is the language of God. Silence is the highest form of prayer. Be still and know that I am God. And I love that. And what do I do after I do 11? I have to do service. It's wonderful, you know, that I can pray and meditate. But unless I'm being useful to somebody, the book says, faith without works is dead. And it says it 3 times. So unless I take whatever I took today to get here, and unless I do my 3 commitments a week that I have in LA, my program is worth nothing. You know, because the book says, when everything else fails, it doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater. You know, when everything else fails, go and find somebody to work with, to help with. You know, I think the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are the most incredible spiritual tools of the 20th century. I believe our program is the greatest spiritual program in the of the century. We are in 160 countries. And LA alone has 2,500 meetings a week. And it's here, and it is for nothing. We don't have to pay for it. It's magnificent, you know. And I did all my amends, and I worked the steps. But after 3 years, you know, of sobriety, I didn't feel good. And I didn't know why. You know, and I had everything. I bought a house, I had another car, you know. But I didn't feel good. Something was missing. And I had to make inventory. And after I wrote some things, I realized I still hated my parents. I was ashamed of them. And the book says resentment is the number one killer. And I cannot resent anybody. And that includes parents. You know, somebody said a resentment is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. It doesn't work. You see? And I realized, you know, and I'm not condoning, because my parents, my mom, did some child abuse, and I'm not condoning that. That was wrong. But you know, when I was drinking, I did a lot of wrong things. And I abused a lot of people. And when I went to do my 8th and 9th, I didn't want justice. I wanted those people to forgive me. And I had to forgive my parents. Not for them, for me. Because otherwise that hate, that resentment is going to eat me up. And if I don't forgive my parents, I will be forever a child. Because I will not be able to work with my boss, with my coach, with my sponsor, because I will resent authority. And I remember, you know, thinking about it. We have double standards in Alcoholics Anonymous. If a newcomer walks through that door, you know, and she says, I just got out of jail, I killed 2 people, and I robbed 5 banks, what do we say? Welcome! How are you? You want some cookies and some coffee? And after the meeting, we'll take you out to dinner. Oh, here's the big book, you know. Forgiveness. Instant forgiveness. Not with our parents. They have to be perfect. Are we perfect? I don't know about you, but I know about me. I'm not perfect. Even in sobriety, I had to make many amends. You know, so I began writing, and I realized, you know, yes, my mom did such and such, but that was bad, and that was about 25%. But I looked at the other 75%. She was an illiterate peasant from Italy, but she put me through 12 years of school. She worked at 2 jobs her entire life, from 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, to put me to school, to buy me the books, to send me to the gym. You see? But she was illiterate. She never went to school. See, most of us didn't get it at home, but at least we had the opportunity to learn something in school. My parents didn't have that. And I realized, you know, we were poor, but because we had no heat, she would heat up, you know, a brick on the stove, then wrap it up on a towel, warm up my bed, and put the brick on my feet so I would sleep, you know, nice and warm. And we had no money, so when I was 5 years old, we didn't have money to buy a Christmas tree. So she took a broomstick, some wire, some crepe paper, and she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches. She went out with a quarter and bought 4 Christmas balls, one of each of a different color, and a point. But guess what? I have my Christmas tree. And every year it got a little bigger, and she made a little more designs and, you know, little things for the Christmas tree. And when I was 12 years old, she'd bought me an imported bicycle from Italy, the best money can buy. I'm talking about 50 years ago, almost like buying a convertible to a child now. She was working at 2 jobs to pay for this. You see, she was doing the best she could with the tools she had. She was not perfect, neither am I, even in sobriety. So when I realized all this, I was like 4 years sober, I sent her a ticket to Argentina. She had never been on a plane. And she took a plane to LA. And she came to my apartment. And she had a 12-foot-tall Christmas tree, real pine, decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And she had 33 presents underneath the Christmas tree, wrapped in those colors. 33 presents. We overdo things in AA. And I told her how much I loved her. And I thanked her for everything she did for me. For the schooling, for the books, for the gym, for the drawing lessons. And never, never, never did I mention what she did wrong. We don't do that in AA. We take care of this side of the street. And I brought her again, like 2-3 years later, you know, with my sister. And once she was talking to my sister, Olga, and she said, Olga, you know what I wish for all the mothers in the world? And Olga said what? That all the mothers of the world could have a son like my Hector. Doesn't get any better than that. She died 1.5 years ago, or 2 years ago. She was 91 and a half. And that relationship was healed. That was, I can see only the good stuff my mother did for me. But my father was a little more difficult. He moved to Syria. He remarried. He had another family. I hadn't heard him from like 14 years. And all of a sudden, when I was like 14 years sober, I got a letter from him saying, how you doing, son? I haven't heard from you in a long time. I just want to say hello. And, oh, could you please send me some money? I had to pay some taxes. So can you send me some money? Oh, one more thing. My family here says, if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. If I did, I apologize. Ha! Did you do something wrong? And I began writing back. And I began listing everything he did wrong. And now I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't lie. This is a long list. And I began writing and writing and writing, you know, and telling him off. And then I made a mistake. I asked an old timer what to do. Never do that, newcomers. Ever. And she said, Hector, Hector, if your father took 14 years to write to you, why do you have to answer right away? And Hector, would you rather be at peace? Or would you rather be right? I'd rather be right. I've been waiting 50 years for this, you know. But I'm a people pleaser, and I sent a nice letter, a loving letter. But it was not enough. It was not enough. I still felt uncomfortable. So I went back to my shrink, the one who sent me to AA, you know, 20 years ago. And after 2 sessions, he said, Hector, you have to go to Syria to be with your father, to meet your father. You don't know your father. Are you crazy, Mike? Syria is full of Syrians. You know what I mean? They all look like my father. I don't want to go to Syria. You're crazy. And I'm a people pleaser, and I called Syria, and they had to bring my father to the phone, and he couldn't speak. He sounded senile. And I told him I'm going to be there in 2 months. So I bought a ticket and landed in Damascus. Oh, God. The big giant that used to beat me up. I'm in Damascus, and this little old man about this tall, bald-headed, wispy white hair, baggy pants, is running towards me, sobbing. And he grabs my face, and he kisses me all over. And I began to sob. And we're both sobbing. Who is this man? I don't know this man. He never talked to me. He either fought with my mother or he worked. And we are sobbing and sobbing. His family behind him are sobbing. People watching us are sobbing. And then he grabbed me by the hand, you know, he puts me in a cab. Just like I'm a 5-year-old. He grabs me by the hand and he takes me to the cabin. And we go to his hotel in Damascus. And he said, you know, son, I was so excited you were coming. I couldn't sleep for the last 3 nights. Then I talked to my brother-in-law. He says, no, your father didn't sound senile when you called him on the phone from America. He was so excited. He was talking to you. He couldn't stop crying. And then he took me to his village, you know. It was so weird that night. I was like 50-something years old, sleeping in the same room with your dad, and seeing this little old man that was afraid for so many years. And then he took me to his village in Syria, this very, very poor place. If you've been to Mexico, you think that's poor. Mexico is like Switzerland next to Syria. And he told me his story. See, he never had a father. His father died when he was 6 months old. His mother was about 15, 16 years old. She never went to school. My father never went to school. He grew up like a little animal in this village. Then when he was 16 or 17, went to Argentina and married my crazy mother. And the marriage from hell was created. You know what I mean? How is man going to know how to be a caring, loving parent? He had no idea. Love is like any other subject. Somebody has to love you and touch you and hug you so you can teach it somebody else or give it somebody else. That's what we do in AA. They love us. They put arms around us. They kiss us. They remember our birthdays. They touch us. Like Father Leo says, we're all skin hungry. We all want to be touched. Nobody did it to him. But he loved me. He really, really loved me. And you know, he followed me around like a puppy dog. And you know what he did in this very, very poor village? He made me dress in a three-piece suit. This very poor village. He sat me in the table in the dining room, put steak in front of me, and made me eat it because steak is very expensive in Syria. He wanted to show off. And he invited all the people from the village to come and say hello to my son from America. And they all had to come and shake my hand and talk to me in Arabic. I don't know what they were saying, you know. It was like a scene from The Godfather, you know what I mean? And I was playing Marlon Brando, you know. Even a blind person without shoes, you know, walked into the house, a beggar, and they guided his hand to touch my face so that he too may know what Brahim's son looked like. That's how much he loved me. I just did not love him. I don't want an illiterate peasant for a father. I want Nelson Rockefeller. I want property, money, prestige, class, baccarat glasses. No, 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 Hector. This is your dad. This is the one you have to love. And we spent 8 days together. And he told me all kinds of things, and I filmed them, and I took pictures of him. And when I left at the Damascus airport, we were both sobbing again. Because I knew I was not going to see him again. Because he was 80-something and I was not going back to Syria. And we were sobbing and sobbing. And I said, Daddy, I love you very, very much. And I'm so proud that you're my daddy. And he grabbed my face and he kissed me in the mouth gently. And he said, Son, I'm 10 times more proud that you're my son. I am so proud of you. And this trip you made to my little village is the most beautiful gift anybody could have given me. No money in the world could make me happier. Now I can die in peace. And sobbed and sobbed and I left. When I came back to America, you know, something had changed. Something very, very subtle. See, I always looked like a man, I acted like a man, I sounded like a man, I accomplished like a man, but inside of myself, I was like a 12-year-old child. Because being like a man was like being with my dad, and I hated my dad. And now when I think about my dad, you know, I smile. And now I know what a real man is, or a real woman. Is somebody who is at peace with himself. It has nothing to do with those things out there. It has to do with the peace that's within. I didn't know that. See, that's the biggest thing I want in my sobriety, peace. Because if I'm at peace, and I'm at one with the divine, if God is percolating inside of me, and I can have that conscious contact, you know, with the inner splendor that's inside of me, I can be at peace. And I can be a better anything, a better father, a better friend, a better sponsor, a better sponsee. I can be much more useful. The book says the purpose of the program is to be of maximum use to God and those about us. And that's what I believe. You know. I'm going to tell you one more thing and I'm going to sit up and shut up. Once, you know, I saw this movie called The Elephant Man. I don't know if anybody saw it. It's about this very ugly, deformed person who is like a monster who lives in the streets and he smells bad and he dresses in rags and he eats garbage from the garbage cans. And the kids throw rocks at him and chase him because he's so ugly and so filthy. You know, and this doctor and this nurse pick him up and bring him to the hospital. And they bathe him and they dress him properly and they love him and they treat him with care and respect. And a change takes place. Not the face is the same face, but we get to see what's inside of him, the beauty that's inside of him. He also is a child of God. And there's beauty inside of him. And this wisdom, he's very talented. He's almost like an architect. And he begins to design a church. And when I saw this, I said, wow, this is the story of all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous. We all feel like freaks when we come here. We feel ugly inside and out. It doesn't matter how we look or how much we have accomplished. We just feel bad. And the love, the care, the nurturing, the guidance that we get in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, little by little, ever so gently, the layers built on fear that we have start falling down, little by little. And eventually the most beautiful person in the world emerges, ourselves. You see, God made no mistakes. We're all children of God. He loved us so much. He created us in His own image. That's how much He loved us. We just had to get in touch with it. We had to just get rid of the layers. How do we do that? By working the steps. Going to meeting. Praying. Meditating. And helping others. This is the greatest program in the world. And it's for free. You know, I came here to stop drinking. And you beautiful people taught me how to live. I want some more. I'm going to keep coming back. I love you and thank you.